and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And today we're joined by Eddie Priscott from All Makes. How are you getting on, Eddie?
I'm all right. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Not at all.
Show? I guess it's a show.
Well, thanks for having us
here on the podcast.
It's a glorious day to be in the Oxfordshire countryside.
I know.
Kind of.
A lovely bit of weather, and we had a very interesting tour around around the All Makes premises, and what a place it is. It is enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the new premises that we moved into in September last year is vast.
Yeah. We were saying, actually, downstairs, we really should coordinate more with Greg so we go with him to do these podcasts.
Greg has obviously been here before us, following him around.
We are just basically following in his footsteps. We've been to Richards, now we're here. I wonder where we're going to go next. But no, again, thank you for inviting us. And I just thought we'd get a bit of background into off-roading, the way, you know, how the parts situation is now, where the trends are going, and talk a little bit about what you do.
So yeah.
Where did it all start for you then? What got you into Land Rovers?
Well, four-wheel drives before Land Rovers, really. When I grew up, my father ran a garage in Wallingford in Oxfordshire. In fact, it was probably Berkshire back then. And his passion was Jeeps. And he was a military Jeep restorer. He even shipped Jeep spares back to the States, believe it or not. But he's been published in numerous books to do with Jeep restoration. And him and his friends, of which most of them were in Land Rovers, by the way, used to go off-roading together with the All-Wheel Drive Club. And as a kid, there was nothing better than a weekend's off-roading with your dad. You know, it was fantastic. And so we did all those famous off-road sites, Slab Common, Weavers Down, you know, Ticks Over even.
Oh, wow.
So all of those places were off-roaded in donkey's years ago. We are talking, what?
You're so 40, by the way. Yeah.
At least 45 years ago when I first went off-roading.
Wow.
And 35 plus years ago when I probably started off-roading. 40 years ago, actually, when I started off-roading myself.
Fantastic. So, I mean, from Jeeps then, obviously, you say your dad was heavily involved in
that. Yeah.
Where did you finally see the light in coming to Land Rovers?
Well, I started to run a business working for myself, and I service a lawnmower of one of the directors of All Makes, who said if I ever needed any Land Rover parts, come and see them. And because I was doing quite a lot of work for farmers, of course, Land Rovers was the main vehicle that they were using long before double cab pickups became popular. I mean, there might have been the odd Subaru pickup, but in the main, it was Land Rovers series vehicles, and then Defenders, and then they had Range Rover Classics and Discovery Ones. I took up Terry's offer, and we bought a few Land Rover parts, and I thought there's an opportunity here. And so we developed the business. I say we, there was me and one other guy that was working for me back in the day. And we developed a business called North Farm Workshops. And it was in some farm buildings, and we worked majority on Land Rovers. And it would have been everything from welding, repair work, servicing, MOT preparation work. No expedition or off-road preparation at that time. But for fun, we always went off-roading. I mean, it was the one thing, if you owned a Land Rover as a young fella, that's what you did.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I can think back to every weekend I would try and get off-road in my little 90. I absolutely loved it. I guess that's the same for a lot of people who get into it at that age. It's just what you look forward to, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, back then the businesses that I admired when I first started out, you know, all of those guys I knew or met because of their involvement in off-roading. I knew less about their business, almost more about their off-roading capabilities.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, it gives it that. That's what we're finding really going around and talking to people is they've either had a history in it or they're so very ingrained in what we all love that the business is kind of like something they just do.
You fell into the business.
Like
a community. Oh. And they're all suddenly there just helping your mates.
I think the majority of my generation in this business came at it from an enthusiast first, businessman second, definitely.
And I think a lot of that's true today. And we were at Richard Chassis last week, you know, they're enthusiasts first, and then all of a sudden they, you know, the way the chassis were created, there was a need for it.
Oh,
and then later said, can I have one? And all of a sudden there was two chassis, and then there was four, and then God knows how many.
Absolutely. So what was you talk about, you've done a bit of motorsport in your past. What, tell us about that.
Very early on, it was all-wheel drive club trials. We would go there. I don't remember the classes, but I remember they were fiercely competitive, however many there were. And there was always this, you were pissing yourself in a Series 2 bog standard Land Rover against a Haflinger.
Oh, yeah.
Or a Willys Jeep, you know. And the Willys Jeep at the time, there was this rivalry between a Willys Jeep and a series Land Rover as to which was more capable, you know. And I think most of the time it was down to what tyres you had and whether or not you were brave. But the long and the short of it was, you know, we would do everything we could to get our vehicles. And we were doing road tax vehicle trials because we couldn't afford a tow vehicle and a trailer. So we would drive our vehicles to the trial, do our best not to break them, but be competitive, and then come home. And that extended right the way through the Winch Challenge stuff as well. There was very, very, and only in the last few years did we trailer our vehicles to do Winch Challenge events. So, you know, it was an endurance event. You had to be competitive, which we were. You know, we were innovative with kits back then. I've been fortunate enough to drive off-road in quite a few different parts of the world, all over the UK in trials and Winch Challenges. But I've driven expeditions in Africa, in North Africa and South Africa. I've driven across Europe. I've driven the Rubicon Trail in the States. I mean, I didn't take my own vehicle for that, but I have done the Jeepers Jamboree.
Oh, Rubicon is on my bucket list.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mecca. It is one of those top 10 destinations, the ultimate off-road destinations, definitely. You know, 5 days of pure off-roading in glorious sunshine.
Yeah, doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No,
that's wicked. So, Winch Challenges is a subject close to my heart, and unfortunately, I feel like I probably was too young to ever have competed in the glory days of them, when, you know, the vehicles actually looked like Land Rovers, and
yeah,
it was fiercely competitive because there was that closeness in spec, if you like. Whereas,
yeah, initially, when we first started doing Winch Challenges, they were Land Rover derived vehicles in the main. You know, there were one or two other brands, but mostly we took a Defender or a Discovery or perhaps a Range Rover and bobtailed it to take the big, you know, the overhang off. We put the biggest tires we could get under them, the best suspension that we could fit, and an 8274 winch, and then we went to try and pit ourselves against most of them were all friends, you know. We'd all rock up at the same events and we just prayed that, you know, somebody would put on a good event and pick a spot on a mountain and try and get yourself there and score points for it. You know, we did well. Those were back in the days when I was running Frogs Island 4x4. We were fortunate that the business paid for it, and you know, so we were able to be innovative and then sell what we demonstrated effectively over the weekend, and it worked really, really well.
Yeah, so there's an element of, I mean, I've spoken to a few other people from that era, if you like, and they all say the same thing. It was absolutely great, the glory days of it. But I suppose running a Frogs Island was an independent specialist.
It was, yeah, and we developed a few standard off-road packages. I remember the Challenger Pro and the Challenger Pro Plus. They were featured in your magazines. You know, it attracted people that wanted to bring a Defender to us and have it equipped so that they could take on those challenges, whether they competed or not, or whether they just wanted to be part of that scene. It was great. You know, it was a great period. I mean, I think probably the standard vehicle that then became modified probably had that window of about 10 years when they were properly heavily modified. And then it became a little bit space-framed,
yeah,
coilovers and things, and it started to move away from a standard body vehicle. And at that point, I steered the business more toward expedition preparation. And for probably another 10 years, that's what we focused on. And I lost touch with the competitive side of it. So it's quite interesting going back to it now as a sponsor with Terra Firma. You know, for the last 3 years, we've sponsored events like the Welsh 150, Ultra 4. So there's a speed event that's been brought into it. Again, I think that's probably why the vehicles went away from being standard bodied vehicles to much more custom bespoke vehicles with space frame and mid-mounted winches and very, very high performance engines. These things weren't individually, you know, such a requirement in the days when we were doing challenges.
Got you. Yeah. So it's really interesting. It's not, I don't know, it's hard to describe. I think I've just got that from reading Land Rover magazines back in like the early 2000s. That's what I aspired to. I wanted, yeah, 90 with twin lockers and,
yeah,
274s, 35 inch Cymex and all that stuff.
It did seem affordable.
Yeah.
Even, you know, buying an 8274, which at the time was the most expensive winch you could buy, you know, two ARBs and a compressor was an expensive acquisition.
Yeah.
But the sport was still good value. You know, I think it has changed now. Mm. It's a lot more expensive to be competitive than it was. And I think there is still, you know, I wouldn't like to say that the pay and play days have actually replaced the winch challenges, but there does seem to be a bit of a void between having a bit of fun with your mates at the weekend and then the competition scene taking you straight into these, the extreme 4x4 challenge events, which are much more, much more difficult to be successful in.
I wonder how many 90s Range Rovers discoveries that are sat in people's yards around the country still from those days, and they should revive, like have a retro class.
Well, Facebook should sponsor them because most of them are on Marketplace.
Yeah, the old trials.
I'm going to tell him that I'd be looking at it.
Yeah. Oh, I don't. I've thought about it so many times. One of my good friends, actually, he's really into, he's got this sort of, he's not really stuck in the past, but he loves to recreate those vehicles, which is what he does every time he buys a Defender. It ends up looking like that, and they're just, oh, I love it.
Yeah, I think there seems to be a few trends still continuing with the trialer type vehicles. They're still based around a Series 1 body shape.
Yeah.
And I like that, you know. You'd have to call them retro now, wouldn't you? Because they look like they did when we built them when they were new, you know, or in their first incarnation rather than new. I can remember doing an all-wheel drive club event when somebody turned up in a Range Rover Classic for the first time, and it was like, my goodness. And I think it may have been somebody like Keith Gott or somebody like that that had got one that was an insurance write-off, and so they sort of hammered it straight and took it trialing.
Fantastic.
You know, it was amazing. Yeah. You wouldn't get the equivalent now, would you? I don't think.
I don't think so.
So, sorry, you mentioned Terra Firma. We should probably explain to all the listeners exactly what you do, because we've kind of jumped in here, haven't we? Because we know you from the Indian group. But what is your actual job?
So I'm the founder and creator of Terra Firma. My job title here at All Makes is Terra Firma Brand Manager. So I guess you can say I'm responsible for the whole thing. And it came about, 17, 18 years ago, a little bit out of frustration. We were preparing people's vehicles with products from multiple brands, and a slight frustration that products wouldn't fit together, that you'd end up having this Christmas tree of brands bolted to a vehicle. And there were products that weren't available when you specified them, and you couldn't get them when the vehicle was due to be done. And so I started to think, well, maybe I can have my own product range. And that's how it started. So springs and shocks, steering dampers and brake discs, and then brake pads were those first items that we introduced in the range. And now there's over 1,600 part numbers that are all active and live in a catalogue. And we cater for every off-road activity, from entry-level, recreational off-roading or enhancement, right the way through to full-blown competition vehicles.
Very cool. I mean, like you said earlier, it's rare to see any modified Land Rover without at least one Terra Firma part on it. It's like...
Yeah, it makes me really proud. You know, I mean, initially when your product is identifiable in a certain colour, or you might just about be able to see the logo amongst the mud under a four-wheel drive, but now there's so much publicity with social media, with Facebook and YouTube and the magazines. It still fills me with pride when I catch a glimpse of a Terra Firma M or the logo or the colour of a product that I recognise on people's cars. It is, and all over the world, you know, we sell this product to more than 120 countries around the world.
I was going to say, I stumbled across one on Instagram the other day, and it's quite a highly regarded high-end Defender builder, and I thought, hang on, most Radius arms look familiar, and I like did the thing on your phone, make the picture bigger on. Yep, they got the Terra Firma M on them.
Yeah. Oh, it is interesting how certain products find their way far and wide. We know a lot of these special vehicle builders have tried to develop their own product, but quite often they do come back to the brands that people know. It does help them sell their product as well. Their vehicles with a good branded product on it must help them.
Absolutely. You've got that in Terra Firma stuff on your 90, haven't you, see?
I have. Springs, shocks.
Yeah, you've got the new monotube shock absorbers on yours, haven't you?
Yeah, that first one. You fit them.
Yeah, we did fitting guard, didn't we? Yeah.
Is this when you got the bushes the wrong way around?
No, I got the washers the wrong way
around. Let me get that correct.
Oh, that's probably the most talked about fitting error, if it's honest. I mean, even the most experienced Land Rover technicians and mechanics and DIY installers
not just you,
have been known to get the top shock washers round the wrong way.
Do you know, because I remember when we did it, we Googled it, right? That 50% of the people said one way, 50% said the other. and we couldn't work out who was absolutely right.
Set the record straight, Eddie. Top damper washers, yeah. Which way round do they go?
Dished side to the bush.
Right, which allows a little bit more movement.
If you consider...
It looks wrong.
Yeah, because it looks nicer if the dished side is facing away from the bush. But effectively, then you get two flat faces squashing the top shock mount together. And it actually then gives you metal-to-metal contact, which then bends the shock absorber or flexes the shock absorber in use. And that's when they either start leaking or it breaks the top eye off.
And when you hear that, it kind of like, it's logical.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. Like you said, we chatted briefly earlier. You said, obviously, you do get parts that break. That's part of having a part supplying business, running that business.
Yeah.
You never get front dampers come back because all they do is go straight up and down.
That's right.
There's a lot more angle.
Yeah, the side-to-side movement on a front shock absorber on a Defender, Disco 1 or Classic, for example, literally just, I mean, it does scribe an arc, but it virtually goes straight up and down. Whereas the way the radius arm's set up is the shock absorber actually scribes quite significant arcs throughout its movement. And it's exaggerated with longer travel shock absorbers. So if you've got a plus 2-inch or a plus 5-inch shock, I mean, most plus 5-inch, including ours, are now pin-to-pin to alleviate that problem. Whereas a plus 2-inch shock absorber, especially on lower top shock mounts, puts a lot of strain on the top bush on full dropout.
Yeah, I should imagine it does. I mean, the whole suspension has been such a huge, huge part of modifying all models of Land Rover.
And it's the biggest part in our catalogue.
Right, okay.
And for every action, there's a reaction or a consequence. And so even lifting a Defender, we know that you need to change your brake hoses, you're going to affect the steering geometry, your prop shaft angles, all of these things, we've identified where those compromises are or the consequences of your actions are, and we've provided something, a bit of kit or even instructions on how to mitigate it so the car still drives normally. And to that point, you know, there is a desire to lift vehicles beyond 2 inches, but we found that typically beyond 2 inches, it's very, very difficult to fix those consequences. So we stick to typically a 2-inch suspension lift, and all of our hardware is developed around that 2-inch lift.
I maintain, from even being a young guy with a Defender who wanted it to look cool, you never, ever, regardless of model, you never need to lift any Land Rover more than 2 inches. If you need to feel your tyres, get the grinder out.
What? Open up the wheel arches.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not one for cutting the bodywork around. I think you can make a Defender really, really, really capable off-road with a few modifications without going too extreme. But it's not just about capability for some people. It's about how the vehicle looks. You know,
yeah, sure.
If we were all just concerned about capability, we'd have never just built a monster truck that looks fantastic. You know, now even monster trucks are actually made to be capable rather than just bolt the biggest tires you could fit on a pickup. But we try and reduce the potential problems by ensuring that everything works together so that all of our shock absorbers can be fitted with all of our springs. And there is an item of hardware or a range of hardware that you can add to that to make a kit, to make the vehicle perform very well and be more capable, load carrying, towing, off-road for recreational challenge type events, green laning type events, pay and play days, or right the way through to expedition style driving, which is completely different. You do want some wheel travel, but you also want load carrying. Whereas for recreational off-roading, load carrying is not as important as an expedition vehicle.
Absolutely. We were looking around the fleet of Terra Firma vehicles outside. And
yeah.
Very impressive. The Defender was on the cover, wasn't it, before I joined?
And the Discovery too.
Oh,
yeah.
Was it as well?
Yeah.
Because we took it to the quarry, didn't we?
That's right.
Near Kettering.
Yes.
The Discovery
team. Yes.
Really, because you'd launched at that time a load of new...
That was when we developed those Baja style bumpers, the tubular style bumpers.
Yes.
Which have done very, very well. We're now going to move on, and we think there's an opportunity now for how do we say, more hardcore off-road, greater approach angle. The Discovery 2 is definitely the vehicle of choice to succeed the Defender for recreational off-roading. It's got to be done for a price. You know, the Discovery 2 is not making the same sort of money that a classic Defender is. So the amount that people are prepared to invest in it is slightly less. So we need to make sure that the product is competitively priced that will look the part, that will do the job that we intended and have some longevity. So we're going to focus on ensuring that, you know, we rust protect properly, phosphate wash, and then powder coat over the top in a high quality powder coat, something that we've worked very, very hard to do. Not always possible when, you know, we were expected to provide a product to suit the value of the vehicle. You know, you have to then drive down the price. Whereas now we've gone the other way. You know, we've achieved the point at which we can sell a product properly made for the right money.
Well, we were saying, well, we always say, look, the Disco 2s are sort of, there's people who've had them already for off-roading and they're a bit iffy on condition, and they're sort of, there's still the marketplace special. But then the people who are, A, picking them up to modify them are increasingly spending more money on them than they were. And then obviously your real sort of creme de la creme standard ones are really making strong money now.
Obviously the UK prices of a Discovery 2 are significantly less than Europe. I think where our cars have rusted, and Spain and southern France and Italy, for example, the Disco 2s wouldn't have rusted anywhere near as bad. In America, they're still regarded as a competent off-roader and kept in good condition. Whereas in the UK, you're right, the condition will have deteriorated. You'll be buying an MOT failure to now do up as an off-roader. But that means it's affordable for, you know, younger people or people with less budget to get into off-roading and to have a car that, well, I was going to say watertight, but I'm not not sure Land Rover have successfully made a watertight vehicle full stop. But
yeah.
In theory, it's got a bit more comfort to it than a Defender. It's certainly a much more economical proposition to get into off-roading, and we want to encourage that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely get what you're saying. Right. Actually, while I remember, shall we have a little listener's question?
Well,
this one's relevant to what we're talking about. So, on what would it have been, two podcasts ago, we talked about bull bars, didn't we?
We did.
Alistair Reed from Australia has got in touch. He says, I regularly listen to your podcast and it's a great listen while I drive around Queensland. So well done. Thanks very much. Used to live in the UK. He was chairman of the Shire Land Rover Club for several years and competed in winch challenges in his 200 TDI 90 before moving to Brisbane in 2005. And when he moved to Australia, he brought with him his 1995 300 TDI Monte Carlo blue soft top. That sounds all right, honey, doesn't it? Like that. Which was in your magazine in 2004.
I think I know who he is.
Do you?
Yeah, I think he was a customer at Frogs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wicked.
What was his name?
Alistair Reed.
Alistair Reed, yeah.
Do you know?
I think so. You know, I mean, there might have been another Alistair Reed, but I do remember an Alistair Reed going off to Australia with his Defender.
There you go. It's full world, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah. In 2005 would have been at the point that I stopped running Frogs Island 4x4 and was moving over to All Makes.
Well, there you go.
Continue my adventure. So now I'm going to answer one of his questions again.
he goes on to say he's since bought a 110 as well with overland bits on it. But his main response is to our bull bar topic. And he says, when you talk about bull bars in Australia and legality, each state has its own rules to an extent and their own driving license, which I didn't know. But bull bars are legal across the whole of Australia and most people have them on their trucks and you can buy them all over the place from different suppliers. They have to be ADR approved, which is Australian Design Regulations, which I'm sure you know.
I think that's for the airbag compatibility.
Okay. I guess not a problem on Defender, but yeah, he says still gives the hardcore ARB style bull bars and brush bars, which are the bars along the sides of the wings for dealing with wildlife like deer and kangaroos and whatever. He says he hit something in the past and it did do a lot of damage. And Land Rover even sells an option for a bull bar when you buy a new Defender. Obviously, that's very different in the UK.
Yeah.
And yeah, he just sort of gave a bit of a viewpoint really over what things are like over there compared to here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the dim and distant past, we've sold, well, must be thousands of bull bars, thousands and thousands, you know. And I think the legislation is such that if you have a bull bar fitted on your vehicle, it is deemed as legal, but I don't believe that it's legal to sell one.
Right.
I think it was either passed as legislation but not passed as law, but nevertheless, the manufacturers all pretty much unanimously thought the liability is too great to continue with this, and that in the event that somebody's injured by being bumped by a Land Rover or a four-wheel drive with a bull bar on it, it's too big a risk. So along with everybody else, we decided that you know, we would stop producing bull bars and selling bull bars. There was a period, I think, when people felt that an integral bull bar with a winch bumper might be sold as winch protection or winch operator protection. But I think even that now is a little bit of a thin argument. So, you know, unfortunately, because it has been good business and it's one of those accessories that people would still like, because they want their vehicle to look like the one they've seen in the, you know, in the magazines. And the Australian market and the American market, big influences on what we do here.
100%. I still maintain the Americans put together some of the best looking Land Rovers in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that boils down to how much money you're prepared to throw at it.
You still with your finger, ain't
you? Yeah.
Quite possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do think that they are amazing. And I know, having built many, many, many Defenders, some of them can't drive very well.
Really?
Well, you know, you've only got to look at the steering rod angle, for example, on most of these trucks. They would suffer with horrendous bump steer.
Sorry, your vehicles don't drive well. I thought you meant the Americans can't drive well.
No, I think the Americans have bred good drivers. There's no doubt about that. But I think some of the Defenders that I've seen YouTube videos of, or I've seen on social media, you think to yourself, you know, having built vehicles like that myself, it's very difficult to get them to drive really, really nice.
But back in the day, there's ones in the magazine at Utah. There was a yellow one, wasn't there? With like three.
Yeah.
Remember that? Safari.
Oh, yeah.
Safari Guard.
Safari Guard.
Yeah. Oh, I've off-roaded with Greg Jevney.
Oh, really?
A long, long time ago. And it was shortly after he built that Discovery 2, I think it was called a Kalahari.
Yes.
Yeah. The black one. And it was at SEMA show.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to, and I stayed at his place, and we tried to do a deal to bring Safari Guard to the UK. Unfortunately, there was never enough margin in it, and he was too precious about the brand to allow us to make it under license in the UK. Again, another reason why I developed Terra Firma. You know, if you can't beat them or join them, make your own. You know, it's a bit like that.
Sure. I remember Safari Guard had a crazy three-link front suspension.
Yeah, and it worked exceptionally well. I mean, there were faults, and that's how come I know that some of these vehicles that are produced don't drive particularly well. That vehicle, when you jam the brakes on into a corner, used to feel like the back wheel was going to leave the ground. And it had a 5-inch lift on it, and it looked particularly impressive at a distance and up close. And for the style of driving that Greg liked to do was in these sort of what they call wombat holes. And it's all this kind of sandy terrain, but with big washed out gullies. It was exceptional. Oh, yeah. It drove so well.
Great. I remember that front cover in Bell RN back before long, before I worked.
Yeah.
Right. My dream looking around.
Those were inspirational vehicles. Oh, you know, yeah. Camel vehicles were inspirational. The Trek vehicles were inspirational. And individuals' vehicles like Greg's Defender 90 and his Discovery 2 were right there for me. Definitely.
Definitely. 100%. Yeah. Do you remember the, I don't know, I'd ever looked into it, whether it was a company or just something that someone made up. Do you remember the massive Outback import sticker with the kangaroo on it? And like a...
No, that was, that Patrice Ryder, that was his logo, and that was Outback Import in France, and they were the ARB distributor, but they also pulled a lot of other Australian products. Again, the French expedition market, very, very influenced by the Australian off-road scene.
Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting. I've been reading, but yeah, what? Oh, I love going down these streets. Oh, memory lane.
I know you are dragging them up now.
Sorry, I can't help myself. So, Terra Firma. Then Terra Firma. Talk us through what changes you've seen in the market. How are things going?
Well, it's an interesting one. Of course, we haven't seen a new Defender apart from the handful that Twisted have still got, or reportedly still got. We haven't seen a new Defender now since 2016. That means that the bulk of our business, the core of our business, which has been classic Defender, we've enjoyed, you know, production years from 1983 to 2016. I know they've never produced the same sort of quantity as they would have done Range Rovers and Discoveries, but still there's a lot of vehicles for us to sell kit for, to enhance the capability or the looks of. That has slowed. You know, no argument. What has helped is the value of those vehicles is now significantly higher than it was in the 90s, where we were expected to produce products much more cheaply. Now we can produce a high quality product because the value of the vehicle justifies the investment. And it's allowed me to be a bit more creative about the styling of the products. You know, you'll have noticed on our Defender, the Tread Rock Sliders, they're a big step forward in style. You know, and a combination of materials, including aluminium and manufacturing techniques that you just couldn't have justified paying for on a lower value product. So from that point of view, it's very exciting for me. You know, I'd love to sell the same quantity of Tread Rock Sliders as we did the tubular ones, but it isn't the way it is. So we now need to expand our range to cater for every opportunity. So whether it's somebody that wants to enhance their vehicle to look good on the drive, who dreams of off-roading, or whether it's somebody that really does go off-roading and wants to protect the vehicle or carry more or stop quicker, whatever it might be, Terra Firma's aim is to cover all of those bases. So I've seen the shift from recreational off-roading been in classic Range Rovers, where we've cut the roofs off, cut the backs off, stripped most of the body off, turned them into some kind of space frame, you know, buggy, if you like, and then rebuild them back to look like a Defender or a Land Rover of the day. Right through the Discovery 1s, Discovery 2s. Discovery 2 is probably the one, as we said earlier, that's going to be the main off-roader, the recreational off-roader. P38s. I mean, you know, we have seen a handful, but nobody really off-roaded a P38. It was a luxury vehicle while it lasted and then died, it seemed. Mm. And then the modern Range Rovers are not used off-road at all. There are obviously always exceptions to the rule, but none of them warrant us investing in producing accessories for. Discovery 3 and 4, though, I think huge lifespan. We're talking about 2005 to 2016, so long production, lots of vehicles sold, beautiful car to drive, you know, Range Rover quality and driving experience, but still you can bolt some kit on and really, really capable off-road. And yeah, I know we all worry about the reliability of our Land Rovers, and there's lots of negative publicity about the reliability of Land Rovers. I've enjoyed, touching wood. Yeah. I've enjoyed probably 10 years of relatively trouble-free motoring in Disco 3s and Disco 4s. And given the opportunity to drive the Disco 2, Disco 4, or the Defender anywhere, including a bit of off-roading, I'll take the D4, thanks very much. I've got to that age.
Yeah. So your daily is a Discovery 4, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a Discovery 4. You know, not a particularly new one, but it's in very, very good condition. I think as long as it's reliable, I'll keep it. And then when it does finally give up the ghost, if it does, then I'll change it. But for now, I don't see the appeal of a Discovery 5, and I couldn't really see changing to a slightly newer Discovery 4 as worth doing. So I think I'll hang on until I can get into a Defender.
Yeah, fair enough. What's the... we were lucky enough to join you at Britpart to cover some of the fitting of the accessories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Firmer stuff on the latest Defender. What's that? We've looking like
we've developed a comprehensive range of off-road accessories for new Defender L663, as it's known in the trade. Rock sliders, underbody protection, roof rack, rack accessories, some interior products. There's more on the drawing board. I'll keep that to myself for now. You know, we'll give you first dibs on it when the product's available.
Thank you very much.
I've made that mistake before, where I've told people about what we're doing and then I get nagged as to when it's going to be available. These things do take time to develop, but the new Defender has got great potential. There was some concern as to whether people would equip it for off-road but not actually use it. Why would they justify it? But there is a real significant movement to enhance the capability, whether you use it or not. We've not, you know, got into the sort of plastic parts, as I call it. I mean, there's a huge amount of dashboard, interior, center console, door trim parts, all that kind of thing. Unfortunately, it's all available, or fortunately for the consumer, it's all available on eBay, which doesn't leave a lot of opportunity for us. I don't see there's any need for us to continue to dilute that market. So we'll focus on, particularly with Terra Firma, we'll focus on the more off-road and enhancement products.
That makes sense. Yeah, completely. And they do look fantastic modified, the latest Defender.
Yeah.
When you see one, you think...
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I won't harp on about it again too much.
Oh, is he going to bring up the octave?
I am going to bring up the octave. Sorry. When you see that, even with the slightly wider arches and slight, like, it's not even much. It's like 30 mil of extra height on decent tyres. Oh, what a thing.
It's been an incredible success.
Yeah,
They're taking orders for them. Yeah.
One was spotted 4 miles away from our office yesterday.
Was it? No, it wasn't.
Much. I thought some had been delivered. I mean, yeah. I've seen some posts of people receiving them.
No,
so maybe they are out.
Yeah.
It's out of my price range, you know.
Yeah.
But you never know. I mean, you know, they are becoming more affordable. You know, what we in maybe 5 years?
We're 5 years.
5 years since we've been launched.
Yeah.
Another about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, before they're in our price range. I know.
The trouble is, we've always been warned, if you can't afford to buy it in warranty, then you can't afford to run it second hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody does.
And inevitably, we will end up with that headache.
In fairness, though, you do see, I mean, I've been keeping an eye out. You do see a lot of early ones, 20 plates and 21 plates about.
Yeah. Obviously, avoid the 2 litre Ingenium engine version.
Oh, I don't know what you mean, Eddie.
Enough said.
Stalwart of reliability.
Enough said.
Which one would you have?
The 250, I think, with the 3 litre straight six.
Yeah.
Diesel.
Yeah.
Mm. I'd have a P300.
Look, feel it's petrol.
Yeah.
I've been in one. They're nice.
Tracking engine.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I mean, I'd have any of them really, apart from the 2 litre. I'd certainly have an Octa. I'm not sure if I've mentioned the Octa.
Yeah.
No, hugely desirable vehicle. I think I read an article, it might have been, you know, one of the motoring, you know, the regular car mags that said, you know, what is Britain's most desired vehicle? And the survey said Defender, which is great news. You know, I mean, you know, Land Rover is a small vehicle manufacturer in the great scheme of things. I mean, you probably know better than me, but I mean, what are they on, about 400,000 vehicles a year?
I don't know.
You know, it's small for a car manufacturer. And to produce so many Defenders, I mean, you can't drive more than 5 miles on a main road in the UK without spotting a Defender.
No, absolutely.
Just, they must have sold loads and loads of them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the Discovery 3, to answer you, going back to your question, you know, what's Terra Firma into? We want to enhance the capability and performance with an off-road angle for as many Land Rover vehicles as we possibly can. You know, we know that Discovery 5s are limited. We can talk about that in a minute. Certainly Range Rovers and Range Rover Sports don't justify, you know, our investment. So new Defender has got a lot of focus. Discovery 3 and 4 still got a lot of focus. We're going to go back to Discovery 2 and produce some kit that is much more off-road focus, at a price that the off-roaders will be happy to pay. But I'm very excited about the new Defender and how we can try and lead the trends and follow those trends that were already established by the Greg Jevneys of this world that will always be pioneers.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value, and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Right, so before we get on to Discovery 5, which I am quite interested to talk about, we're going to shoehorn in another reader's listener's question.
You just dropped the reader's word.
I know, I've not done that for ages, but... Right, okay. Good afternoon, LRM. I've got a question for you, and I know Martin will love to debate this one. That isn't the reason I've chosen this. I promise.
Right. Okay, here we go.
I've already mentioned Doctor.
Is it a dig at me?
No. No, would I do that?
Okay.
I've been keeping an eye on all prices of Land Rover models, and I've seen that the price of L322s has dipped not long ago, and they're on the way back up now.
Are they?
Right.
I'd like one as a spare to be used periodically and to restore back to A1 condition all round. Not a project, but they all need fettling, don't they, Paul?
Yeah.
What is your view on where the prices are heading for these, and which model do you see as the sweet spot?
Well, I think I do... follow Auto Trader a little bit, because I think I'm always thinking, well, what happens when I need to replace my car? And what strikes me as the best value Land Rover product is the 405 Range Rover.
Really?
Well, I mean, you could argue buy an L322, but you might be buying a huge amount of problems. And it is all about how much you can afford. But 15 grand gets you into an L405 with under 100,000 miles on the clock with a V8 engine.
I see what you're saying, actually.
How cool is that?
That's the bargain.
Do you know what? I think L405 is kind of a little bit forgotten about, really.
Well, what we're talking, 2014 to 22?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, yeah, it was.
21, 22? Yeah. So they've been, you know, I mean, the ones I were looking at were 2015, 2016, which are newer than my Discovery 4.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, a good Discovery 4, let's say 2016 Discovery 4 with 60, 70,000 miles on the clock, it's going to cost you 20 grand.
It is, yeah.
Well, you can buy a 405 for less.
That's true. I remember when the 405 first came into Deba's before I'd left, PDIing them was a nightmare because the battery's in the boot under the spare wheel.
All right.
But they were absolute. I mean, I'm, as everyone knows, absolutely love the L322.
Yeah.
The L405 was like, and it didn't surpass it.
Yeah.
It was like the interior.
I mean, it was like the difference. It was the same distance in terms of evolution between Discovery 2 and Discovery 3.
Yeah.
Between L322 and 405. Big, big gap in luxury, performance, comfort, equipment. Reliability too, as to be said. Super car. Obviously, you're not going to use it off road. You might use it in a field with a caravan behind. I wouldn't. Maybe that's a subject of another podcast.
Caravans.
But hell of a car, I thought, for the money in my research. Range Rover Sports. You know, the early 2005 to 2010 Range Rover Sports have become very, very good value. Cheap car, really, if you're prepared to take the risk with 3-litre TDV6. For all the negativity, there are tens of thousands of them that have done 250,000 miles without any problem. So, it's one of those things. You pay your money, it takes your choice.
Yeah.
But going back to the question, L322, there's a lot of choice.
I'll expand quickly. Sorry. I feel the prices of 4.4 TDV8 are a bit high. Considering most,
you know why,
over 100,000 miles,
because the 4.4 is
good
ace.
Yeah. He reckons the place to be. This is Adam Wormington again, a loyal podcast listener. He says the place to be is 3.6 TDV8 or 5-litre supercharged. He says the 4.2 sounds great, but the performance isn't brilliant. And he says forget Carx and spec, because people think if they've got a green one with clear windows, they can add 10 grand to the price.
Yeah, well, Clarkson's Farm's about to come on air again, isn't it? So it might keep the value up for a bit longer.
Might well do.
I happen to like what I call the professional colours. So the green, the grey, I'm not a black car person, but the farmer's versions I liked.
I agree. And actually, you mentioned Range Rover Sport. That, you could argue, if the trouble is so many of that shape, when we were out and about the other day, so many of them got the stick-on chrome, the 22-inch wheels.
Yeah, so not terra firma, unfortunately.
We saw the sorry estate Range Rover Sport, didn't we?
It was day. Red. And
it had the rim, wasn't it?
All rust, all bumbled up the rear quarter. And I just thought, that's such a shame, because someone bought that new and they loved it, and it's gone to that. But if you get one in the right spec, I think, Cairns Blue, Tonga Green,
yeah,
silver, without privacy glass and with 19-inch wheels, they still look so contemporary.
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah, and a hugely capable vehicle. I was given a lift in one just before Christmas, and I thought, this is nice.
Mm.
You know, and yeah, it was a nearly 20-year-old car.
It's crazy to think they're that old now, isn't it?
And I thought, actually, it's really, really good. And, you know, if you're going to use it as your daily driver, be prepared to get a span around it.
Yeah.
And fix perhaps some electrical gremlins that might have crept in. But, you know, I think the V8 diesels were great. The petrol engines are lovely, but, you know, and you wouldn't want to drive one on a daily basis, I think, doing sub 18 to the gallon. I think I'd rather be doing 25 to 30 to the gallon, which the V8 diesels are capable of doing.
From a DIY perspective, the Sport is tons easier to work on than the L322.
Is it?
I think so. I certainly...
I mean, are we talking about... I mean... You know, I have the capability, and I wouldn't say that I'm spoilt, but I've got to a time in my life where I'd rather leave the servicing to somebody else. I spend my time bolting kit on if I can, rather than servicing.
Yeah, yeah. I see.
I mean, it depends what you want to do, doesn't it? I think if you want to buy a car and somebody else service it, I would go for the newest, best one I could get. If you want a car to work on yourself, then get the oldest, most affordable, cleanest, tidiest one you can.
Yeah, that's sage advice. So in answer to your question, Adam, you want L405 or Range Rover Sport?
Well, or a Mint 3.6 TDV8 L322, like you said.
Okay, cool.
And I don't expect it to cost them a lot of money.
Probably not, no. If you avoided the one with the premium, the Clarkson premium.
Yeah.
Clarkson tracks.
So there's your answer. Yeah. And he just ends by saying, would you bother hanging around and looking specifically for things like the 360 cameras and all that jazz? Personally, I wouldn't bother because they're a nightmare and the bits are quite expensive.
I think that's the kind of thing that if it failed, is probably uneconomical or unjustifiable to repair. If it's working on the car you find, then bonus. But I wouldn't go searching for that spec. No. I mean, when I changed my Discovery 3 to Discovery 4, the HSE spec was quite important for a couple of things. I love the rain-sensitive wipers, and the auto-dim mirrors are fantastic, but the rest of it is kind of a little bit academic. So it's what you like, isn't it? What the specification list that you're drawn to. I mean, there's probably still functions on my car that I don't even know are there.
I'll chuck a curveball then. I think the perfect spec for Disco 3 and 4 is an SE.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get Harman Kardon, you get all the parking sensors and all the good stuff, but you can choose it without sunroof.
Yeah.
My Discovery 3 was SE.
Was it?
Because I didn't want sunroof.
Mm.
Perfect.
Because you don't want the leak.
Didn't want the leak.
Yeah.
And it had enough kit on it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It was luxurious enough.
Yeah.
Without going that step up.
The nice thing about both the Discovery 3 and Discovery 4 is that on air or with an air-to-core conversion kit, the approach angle and the departure angle are pretty good.
Yeah.
The size of wheel and tyre that you can fit is good in proportion to the size of the wheel arch without cutting the wheel arches about. You do have to trim the corner, the front corner of the body outrigger on a Discovery 4 particularly, to allow the largest size tyre that we would recommend so that it doesn't rub. But the car looks in proportion and is really, really capable. You know, it isn't going to go quite as far as a Defender in the right hands, but in an average off-roader, you know, you're going to have a lot of fun in that car. And that brings me on to the Discovery 5 issue, because we haven't developed any accessories for the Discovery 5 for a couple of reasons. One, and you'll look at this when you're driving home, the sill to the ground level, or the sill in relation to the hub centre, is very low. So
more car-like.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it's Land Rover's designed it that way for a reason, probably safety, probably the size of the doors to get in and out of are so much bigger. But it means that the car is very deep in the body, and when you bolt a rock slider underneath it, you've got no ground clearance.
Yeah.
Likewise, the wheel arch is very small in relation to the wheel and tyre diameter, so you are a bit restricted on putting slightly larger diameter tyres on it. And the overhang is colossal on the back. Oh. I mean, it's just huge.
This hasn't grown on me. It's all just grown.
No, and that I think they've been probably Land Rover's least popular vehicle.
Well,
new vehicle.
It's no secret that many people who would have come out of a Discovery 4 have looked at Disco 5 and gone, "Nah, you're all right," and they've bought a new Defender.
Mm.
That's
nice if you can make that transition.
It's not a horrible problem to have, is it?
No.
It just hasn't. I don't think there's enough cars out there. It doesn't lend itself to equipping particularly well. I don't actually think it would be particularly good off-road. I know there's one or two out there that are used quite heavily and would argue that point. But in the main, if you had the choice of a 2016 Discovery 4 or a 2017 Discovery 5 to go off-roading in, which would be the more capable? Absolutely, hands down, the Discovery 4. You wouldn't be knocking great chunks off it on Strata Florida for a kickoff.
Yeah, 100%. What I find, from a used perspective, I don't hate the Discovery 5. I think I would struggle to choose it over a lot of other stuff, but the diesel engines in them are just... make me bury my head in my hands, because if you want an early one, you either choose 2 litre Ingenium or 3 litre TDV6. And let's be honest here, that's like spinning the barrel of a revolver, isn't it?
Yeah, well, don't wish too much bad luck on my 3 litre TDV6 and Discovery 4.
Sending good positive
good vibes, yeah. But I know, I mean, definitely the value option in D5 is an Ingenium.
Yeah.
And to drive, they're remarkable. You know, the performance is really good. You think, well, this is actually really good. But they just don't, I mean, they're shockingly expensive when they fail. And, yeah. And you know, it's just such a high risk because they are.
Isn't it? Same engine.
Yeah, it's just such a
few miles a moment.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start up a business retrofitting the 2.2 from Freelander 2 into everything.
Well, I don't know if anybody's managed to monetize the Ingenium Owners Club Facebook page, but if they have, they're doing very well because it's got a huge number of followers.
I bet. Yeah, we shouldn't be doing, it's not doom and gloom.
No, we're not. We don't want to diss the brand either because, you know, it's kept us in jobs. Well, me, all my life. And whilst I have an overriding enthusiasm for four-wheel drive, I think four-wheel drive is probably where I come from, off-road, and it wouldn't matter what it is. I have enjoyed a lot of off-roading all over the place and different types of off-roading, from challenge events to trialing to comp safariing to just playing, you know, just going off and seeing if you can get over a hill.
Yeah.
You know, I've loved it. And, you know, I still feel the urge, and when I look at four-wheel drives, I think, oh, you know, what can I put on that to make it better? You know, that's where I come from. I like all the modifications. You know, when I see people have modified vehicles to become game viewers or put in a fertilizer spreader on the back of it, and how they've overcome the problems of putting the weight in a certain place or which part of the body they've cut off and how they've remade the roof, you know, all of that stuff, I just love it. And I like to think that Terra Firma plays a part in all those modifications, because particularly if it's suspension or braking, steering upgrades, you know, a lot of Terra Firma deals with the problems that those people will encounter when they're modifying their trucks.
100%. Yeah, it's great. I think, well, like you just said, Land Rover has served everyone, UK and worldwide, with a way of just getting out there and having fun, off-roading, adventures, overlanding, just doing daily stuff better than almost everything else. Like, yeah. We can talk trash about the engines, but as a vehicle, they are just...
I wonder how many of the vehicles where the engines do fail actually then get written off, or if somebody does something with them. I'm fascinated by these guys that are going off and buying Range Rover Sports with a TDV 6 3.6 and putting them in a Discovery 3 or 4. You know, it's a huge amount of work.
Oh.
Or the BMW M57s, which make me smile. I mean, I'm not a BMW fan per se, but that M57 just seems to be able to light up 35-inch Maxxis Trepidors like nothing else, which makes me grin. I love a powerful diesel.
I forget the name of the company, but someone's put an M57 twin turbo in an L405 now.
Really?
Yeah. The TDV8 conversion, which is really hot at the moment, MDRS up north are doing a lot with it. Because obviously you could buy the Range Rover Sport with the TDV8 factory, yeah, and in fact the 4.2 supercharged, and they share so much architecture, yeah, with Disco, yeah, 3 and 4, slightly more complicated. They are a fairly, not straightforward, but when you...
Yeah, it's not an alien swap, is it?
It's packageable.
Yeah. You know that the bits are made to fit.
Exactly. They're the same chassis, essentially. Yeah. Sport is shorter wheelbase. So, yeah, there's that solution. And I think TDV8 Discovery is hard to ignore, really. That would be a pretty unbeatable all-rounder.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. I think so. And if you are unfortunate enough to have got a late Discovery 4 that's immaculate, high spec, and the engine fails, then you probably would look for a great alternative and find the money to keep it on the road.
Definitely.
But I hope there is a life for 2-litre Discovery 5s, because, you know, it's a lot of car not to keep going.
Yeah, definitely. I think that people are popping up now doing Ingenium repairs, and I don't think, compared to a lot of other manufacturers, I don't think the replacement crate engines are horrendous money. But, and I'd like to think they would have received upgrades and, you know, they'd been sorted out, essentially. But
yeah,
I do get it must be disheartening as an owner to have an Ingenium fail and then, am I replacing it with another problem?
And, of course, most of the people that are bellyaching on Facebook probably aren't Land Rover enthusiasts. So, you know, you have a different tolerance level if you're a Land Rover enthusiast. Or even a different expectation.
Yeah, it's going to go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to go wrong, and I'll look forward to it because I can then modify it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes back to, I've heard it more and more recently, people who buy Range Rovers won't ever buy anything else, regardless of how much of a headache the car's been.
No. They forgive it and get the next one.
And people have said to me, you know, all these years, people have said to me, what else would you have if it wasn't a Land Rover? I just can't think.
I'm going to ask you that question.
Actually. Can't think. I see things on the road and I think, well, that looks interesting. And then I think, would I have one? And then I think, I could think of more reasons not to have one of those other cars. I mean, my Discovery spends most of its time with the back seats down because I'm carrying garden stuff around in it, bits of wood and things like this. So, you know, a Transit would probably be a more practical alternative.
Yeah.
But then I lose the comfort. I lose the off-road capability. I lose the affection for the brand as well. If I change brand, that would be, you know, I mean, I know I've got my Willys Jeep, but that's a childhood.
You still have a Willys
Jeep. Yeah. It's a childhood sort of fantasy, really, that I said to my dad I would have one day, and over the years there's always been the opportunity to get one, but 10 reasons why not. And then I had the opportunity and took it, and I absolutely love it. And it only comes out on days like this when the sun's out. There's no risk of getting wet because I refuse to put the top on it because it looks silly.
They do look top heavy, don't they?
And it's great with the windscreen down, even though at 30 miles an hour you feel like you're beaten to death by the wind. But and, you know, I have a similar affection for all old four-wheel drives, to be honest. I love the old stuff. I really do. And, you know, when I ran Frogs, we did a lot of restoration work. And then often those restorations came back to have a better engine or power steering or coil springs or something to enhance them, but retain that fantastic styling that all old four-wheel drives. I mean, you know, best-looking four-wheel drive out is a Series 1, isn't it? If you're an enthusiast, everybody looks at a Series 1 and goes, that's cube.
Yeah, look at it.
And they're so capable.
Yeah, they are fantastic things.
I love it. Yeah.
That whole sort of, again, I hate to be so backwards facing, but that whole sort of time where all the manufacturers were bringing out their first four-wheel drive and competing with each other, and it was so closely fought, but everything was so different. It's just like, wow.
I mean, whether it's my age, I don't know, but I mean, my group of friends all like old four-wheel drives, you know, and some of them would say, oh, you know, I prefer that or I prefer this, but at the end of the day, their interest is in Austin Champs, not even four-wheel drives, Morris Minors. You know, my friends have all got an eclectic range of classic cars, old cars, some not the most desirable, but they just enjoy that ownership of something classic.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
And most of them, to be honest, do fiddle around with them themselves. They don't pay people to work on them. You know, they're classic cars or they're classic four-wheel drives. They do work on themselves.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
It seems to be a recurring theme, doesn't it? We go and chat to people and everyone just likes tinkering about old stuff.
Yeah.
You will have, by the time you listen to this, we will have been back from Newbury, which is actually just up the road from...
I'm going there now.
You are, aren't you? You're going on. I'll sort of go home and you get to go and...
I'm so pleased, you know, speaking to you earlier, that there's this appetite for trading parts to rebuild and restore and keep going older four-wheel drives. I mean, what would be the newest parts that would be sold at these sales?
You do see some modern stuff, don't you? Discovery 3, Discovery 4 stuff.
Yeah.
Because again, the owners who've got those things have also got stuff.
So. Discovery 3 you can buy for $2,000 now, and you might be looking for a second-hand wing to put on it, might you? Or a clean bonnet or whatever.
Yeah. You get a bit of 3-under-1, 3-under-2 stuff. Mm. You just get really an eclectic mix. But there's still, you know, you get a lot of overseas visitors there that come over on the ferry in the middle of the night, ready for the Sunday morning. Or they'll stay on a Saturday.
Yeah,
and then they're looking for that elusive path. But they all come together, you see. They're on a shopping list with all their mates, wads of cash.
I mean, the thing is, people are still turning up stuff for Series 1s, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think John Craddock might lie to think that he's snaffled everything up, but I do believe that there are still new old stock parts floating around that somebody will have bought that find their way onto tables at sales, which is fantastic. Give that person the perfect opportunity to go, oh, I've got an OE1.
It keeps people coming back.
There's that real hunger for the new old stock stuff, wax paper and the grease paint parts. People go mad for it. And a lot of the stuff did end up going over to Europe years ago, and some of it is coming back in.
Which
is more expensive now.
You've got to pay for it. Yeah, if you want it, you'd be willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
But no, it's really, really good. I can't wait. I'll be there on the sun. Well, Saturday night.
And the weather forecast is good.
It's looking to be like this. I mean, obviously, we it's like being at an airport, is it? Looking out. Yeah. It reminds me of an airport. The big glass, we're in a big glass fronted building, aren't we?
Yes. Overlooking every office has got a full glass wall on it, which is beautiful on a day like today.
So we just saw, we got distracted a few minutes ago. We saw the Muntrac just walking.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I know. It's a bit weird, isn't it? That Milton Trading Estate, where we're based, on the outskirts of Milton Trading Estate, is one of the largest trading estates in the south of England. And yet there's enough green space between the buildings for deer to be happy to live.
Wander up.
Yeah, I know.
Looks both
crazy, isn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah, perfect. Well, Eddie, thank you ever so much for your time, and thank you for having us.
You're very welcome.
And no doubt we'll see you soon.
Well, maybe we can think of something else to talk about. We'll do it again.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, definitely. We're always dreaming of stuff to yap on about in podcasts, aren't we?
Pretty much.
Great stuff. Well, yeah, thanks again for joining us. And for your listening at home, don't forget, please do leave us a little rating or a review. Send any questions to editorial@lrm.co.uk. And have a good one. We'll catch you next week.
Bye for now.
See you all.